So our next set presenter is Mike Pizzi. Mike's been with E*TRADE since 2003. Over that time period, he's worn a lot of different hats: corporate treasurer, CFO, and most recently, in September, was anointed the COO, overseeing tech operations as well as finance functions. So Mike, certainly a lot of responsibilities you have there.
Yeah.
With E*TRADE's reputation as the irreverent disruptor within the retail brokerage space, really couldn't think of a better presenter for our fintech forum. So Mike, really appreciate you being here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So before talking about some of the bigger picture themes within the space, really just wanted to touch on the monthly metrics briefly. It looks like you guys saw some growth in cash as well as pretty healthy retail engagement. Was hoping you can just speak to what you're hearing from your retail client and what sentiment is like, especially given the recent recovery in the markets.
Yeah, I mean, we're very pleased with the metrics here for February and really how this year has started off. I'd say if we went back to the first of the year, we've had a degree of uncertainty with the volatility in Q4, and volatility specifically in December that we saw. But the investor really picked right up from an engagement perspective. This is a highly engaged marketplace. The retail investors are very involved. You can see it all across the metrics, whether it's in the high DART number that we reported this morning, whether it's in the net buying. We're running around $1.9 billion in net buying in the first 2 months of the year. If you sort of annualize that out, that's on pace to where we were last year. So very much a very actively engaged environment. The retail trader is still very engaged. Customers are still very active in the marketplace overall. And of course, that's very good for our business.
So Mike, as the COO overseeing the technology side as well as the operations side in terms of your broader responsibilities, was hoping you could update us and just, given that we're at the fintech forum, what some of your digital priorities are in your current role?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think first off, just remember, every interaction really at E*TRADE begins in that digital realm. We are, at the core, a technology-driven company. It touches everything that we do. We are digital-first in our platform. So we're always going to look at ways to derive a more compelling user experience, to put out more tools and resources for our customers, to build a more compelling experience overall. But we're also going to look at the platform that we operate, the infrastructure that we run on, and how do we make that better? How do we drive that to be better for our business and for our customers? So starting really there in the infrastructure and the platform, you know, 2 years ago, we began a journey really around moving to agile development methods, really empowering our developers to work directly with product in getting product, getting new initiatives out the door, and sort of getting that sort of the product focus into the development teams. Really building out test automation, embracing DevOps as a methodology really by which we develop internally. We have come a long way, and we've made great progress, but we still have work to do, and we are still continue to move that and that evolution going forward. We are looking very carefully at automation. You know, where can we redesign systems or code? Where can we deploy robotic process automation to really drive greater scale and efficiency across the platform? We're making key investments in areas where we think that automation is going to pay off for us and deliver that scale and deliver that efficiency. And we're also looking at cloud technology and where we're going to adopt that and how to really drive that scale and efficiency forward as well across our entire infrastructure. Now, on the customer side, a continued focus on user experience, ease of use, building that out, but also looking at efficiency there. What we can do with chatbots, we introduced one last year. What we can do in terms of just improving things like authentication to reduce inbound service calls so that our service and sales professionals can really focus on more value-added activity overall. We're making an investment in data analytics and modernizing our data analytics so that we can get true customization both in marketing and in sort of how we approach our customers to know that customer set in a very real way. All of these things are how we're driving forward. We're building out our API library so that so that others can connect to the E-Trade platform in a very real way as well. And that's very important when you think about what we're doing in the institutional business, where you have corporate customers, where that connectivity is key. So both on the advisor side and in corporate services. All of these are what we're building on, how we're building our future, and what we're driving towards as a company today.
So Mike, we've actually seen some, including Barron's most recently in their annual assessment or ranking of the different online brokers. You guys made a lot of progress there. I'm just wondering, in terms of the improvement in your ranking, what specific enhancements have you made that you think has really driven improved traction with clients? And how do you think about that as an acquisition tool, as you think about areas to drive net new asset growth?
Sure. At the highest level, it's again focusing on that sort of ease of use, that sort of seamless execution across platform, that common experience, whether it's on web, tablet, mobile, really bringing all of those tool sets to life across all of our platforms and doing it in a very intuitive and easy-to-use way for our customers. That is not the result of 1 year's worth of work in terms of what the survey has moved. That's really the result of a vision that has come together over time as we've sort of driven priorities and driven development. Internally, we call it our voice of the customer framework, where we take what our customers want, the feedback they're giving us, and we prioritize those developments in real time into things that we're going to fix, things that we're going to release, and ways that we're going to make the platform more compelling overall. Now, to be more specific, you know, in terms of our trading application, we didn't just stop at the integration of the OH platform and call it Power E-Trade. We really created a new experience for customers. We made it completely customizable for the user experience. We added new tools and screeners. We added all sorts of analyzers. We really seek to really help the customer from ideation through to execution. How do they find a trade idea? What's the right trade idea to analyze? How do they test it and backtest that trade idea, examine it, look at it with advanced charting, the execution of the idea? And then last year, really improving the risk analytics. Once the customer and that core trading customer has a position, really giving them the tool set to truly visualize the risk that they have on. All of these really coming together and driving the Power E-Trade offering in the marketplace, and I think that's what Barron's was recognizing. Now, on the other side, really in investing product, we've done a lot there as well. We've made our core portfolio, that's our robo offering, more simple, more intuitive, more easy to use. We improved the reporting of all our managed portfolios in terms of what the customer sees from a performance and summary perspective on each period. We've launched thematic investing for customers that want to invest according to a certain theme. And for the simplest, for the no-frills experience, we've included pre-built portfolios out there for customers. So the breadth of product and the user experience has improved across investing as well. This is the result of many years' worth of work, and I'm very happy to see Barron's recognize that and how it all came together this year.
So Mike, as you think about the options business, you did talk about the OH acquisition. That's become a more meaningful contributor to your overall revenues. Curious if you could speak to the competitive dynamics within the active trader space, and in particular, some of the recent remarks relating to pricing by one of your competitors, suggesting that options is an area where maybe the pricing could get more aggressive or you could see further cuts by some competitors.
Sure. Option customers are some of your most value conscious. When we talk about value conscious, price is one element. But if you go back to what I was just talking about, the platform and what they're getting on that platform, all of the tools, all of the charting capabilities, the spectral analysis, everything they're getting across the board that we're giving them, they become very platform loyal. They want the tool set is what drives their trading capability. So value is an exchange for service. So I would think the elasticity is lower in around these option customers in terms of sensitivity to price. I think we are at an equilibrium in pricing overall, and I think it would be highly irrational to try and drive share by price on this customer base because they are going to be responsive to platform, but also with platform, they're going to be responsive to service, right? We take pride in our service offering. We have a large number of people in Chicago who are our derivative service team. If a customer calls in, with a complex option strategy, they will get someone that understands the complexity of that strategy that they can talk through. Customers value that experience. So your service matters. Your execution quality matters. These are sophisticated customers. They're not going to be fooled by some so-called free offering that takes its profitability in a different mean. They know the value of a good fill. So, you know, broadly, as we sort of think about this customer base, you know, we feel that we're engaging them the right way with product, with service, with execution quality across everything we're doing to drive our business forward.
So as we think about the, it's a great transition to thinking about the more traditional retail brokerage client, where you have seen some new entrants in the space, Robinhood a couple of years ago, SoFi more recently, try to get more aggressive with pricing in an effort to attract and broaden out the number of clients that they can add. Curious how you see the competitive landscape evolving and whether you view them as a meaningful threat in terms of revenue and market share.
We look at any entrant into the space, as well as the existing players in the space when they upgrade or change their platforms. And we really look at what they're doing from an experience perspective. Are they getting resonance with sort of the platform they're putting out there, how with customers? Broadly, when we look at the new entrants, we see limited capabilities from a platform perspective, limited service offerings, and something that's not going to be compelling to the marketplace that we're serving. That sort of active trading segment, as well as sort of that core self-directed investor that really wants to see investing tool sets, how to build a portfolio, how to look at their retirement plan and do it all themselves. It's really about the product and span and capability that you're putting out there. We think we resonate very well from a value proposition to our customers. And I think the proof point of that is we don't see material asset flows to any of these startups. We don't see asset flows from them. So at this point, we don't see the disruption, and we, you know, our focus is to make our experience more compelling and better so that we are driving innovation.
So maybe just switching gears to the corporate stock plan side of the business, Mike. You know, this is a really exciting business. It's definitely one where investors have been spending a lot of time digging into, and you guys do have a leading market share in this space. I was hoping you can just set the table and maybe give people some perspective and some background on that business, what it entails, what services you provide to your clients, and how critical is this element to the E-Trade growth story?
Sure. We love to talk about this business. We are the leader in stock plan administration. For those that don't know what that means, for any public company that has an equity compensation plan, so they're paying employees in restricted stock units, stock option plans, employee stock purchase plans, we provide software to those companies that is in the number one position. We made investments years ago into this business and continue to actively invest in it to drive the platform to be number one. We make the stock plan administrator's life easier. Whether that's in filing your Ks or your Qs, whether that's in the Form 4s for executives, whether it's tax reporting, whether it's for your international employees and language and sort of the participant experience there, we make the administration of those plans as easy as possible. And so that complex plans find a natural home on our software. We have a leading position in this space. We're about 20% of the S&P 500. We're heavily weighted in the growth sectors of technology, pharmaceuticals, and biotechnology overall from a client perspective. So our clients are growing as well, which is really, you know, helpful in sort of growing our business with it. Overall, you know, that's what drives the business. We carefully listen to these customers. We have a client advisory board. I talked a little earlier what we do on the resale side. This is what we do in stock plan. We gather our clients together. We listen to what their feedback is. We build that into the next generation and tell them when the enhancements they're looking for are going to be built into the platform. Overall, it's a great experience. But we didn't just stop there. We didn't stop with what we're doing for the stock plan administrator. We also built out one of the most compelling participant experiences in the space. Or the most compelling. I mean, I'm a client myself. You can log on. You can see every single stock grant you have, any performance characteristics of a performance share unit, your employee stock purchase plan, all in one screen, all the information you need, your vest dates, what's coming up, what your plan will look like forward as things vest, what its unvested value is, all the information you need, your tax basis, your tax reporting. We have made the participant experience compelling. That participant experience resonates back to the HR officers who are making the decision around plan administration software. And that's why I can cite the most outstanding statistic. We are winning 70% of plans that go to RFP in the space.
So, Mike, one of the interesting dynamics, too, that you guys disclosed in the third quarter was cash balances actually being a key part of that business as well, where the cash contribution from the corporate stock plan side is actually pretty meaningful. NII, it's two-thirds of your revenue. It's an even larger proportion of overall profits. I was hoping you can give some context as to how the corporate stock plan business specifically drives increases in cash, given that's such a fundamental driver of earnings growth from here.
Sure. When we source an account from corporate services, and this is a very valuable feeder channel for us, it's about a third of our gross new accounts. That retail account has a companion stock plan account that is generating an evergreen asset flow. It's getting more stock in every year. It's an employee as if they're growing their career, their stock plan is growing. It's going to generate assets that they then move into their retail account and execute their investment plan with, whether that's trading-based or long-term investing or whatever business they're conducting with us. That evergreen sort of flow of funds generates a cash inflow that causes these accounts to have higher average cash. Some customers may just hold some cash for safekeeping that they intend to, you know, spend later in the year and buy a house or tuition or even just the tax payment on the sale of the stock from the prior year that could be held in cash. All of that drives a higher cash weighting on those customers. That leads to a substantially higher revenue yield on those portion of client assets. It's substantially higher, about 70 basis points higher overall, no, 70% higher overall than the revenue yield on an organically driven asset. So not only is this a valuable feeder channel, it's a valuable feeder channel of the most valuable accounts.
So, Mike, as you think about that setup in terms of the competitive landscape, it is a reasonably fragmented space. We did recently see Morgan Stanley acquire Solium. I was hoping you could speak or give some context as to how you see the competitive landscape unfolding within the corporate stock plan space, and maybe more specifically, just how you think about the ultimate prioritization of growing inorganically versus organically within the channel.
Sure. We see the acquisition of Solium as a proof point. It's a point of validation to our strategy. Acquiring software that is ranked number two to ours to really gain traction in the administration market validates the downstream value of the trades and assets that come from this business. In terms of looking at it from a model perspective, you know, imitation is a form of flattery, and we see that clearly in looking at gaining traction in stock plan, building out a participant experience, driving value from those downstream assets. But today, we don't really necessarily see this as anything that's going to drive immediate disruption. Morgan Stanley was already sort of recommending complex clients to use Solium software. So all they're doing is bringing that in-house of something they were already making the recommendation on. So it's not going to drive disruption to our business. And in some sense, there are non sort of Morgan Stanley referrals or clients from other wirehouses into Solium. That generates an opportunity for us because they may be left without a home. So that's going to continue some of the disruption that has been going on in this space, allowing us to drive our growth forward. And so we're very optimistic that we will continue to win, that we will continue to challenge in this space, and continue to drive our growth there overall.
Excellent. Mike, you touched on this a little bit, but you mentioned the more than 70% win rate in terms of new mandates. Now, one of the things that we get a lot of questions on is what really differentiates your platform relative to a lot of the competitors that are out there, just to give some context as to what's driving that level of success.
Sure. I mean, look, it's a lot of the things I already said in terms of customized reporting, making your financial statements easy. I mean, if you think about this business, you have to track enormous amounts of tax records in terms of client tax positions. You have to do that in multiple jurisdictions. We make that easy. right? That's really the value driver from the stock plan professional's point of view. We also, equity comp is an area where many companies will say their lower-level employees are not valuing it. They're not valuing it because they can't see it. We've given them a compelling experience to look at their plan value, to look at how their plan's going to behave over time, to look at the sensitivity to their company stock price. That participant experience is resonating with those companies as well. They're getting more than just a piece of software. They're getting an entire client experience for their participants. That's what's driving us to win 70%.
And so as we think about another area that you've recently entered, the independent RIA channel, you acquired TCA, which was a platform, in April of 2018. This historically has been an area that's been perceived to be more of a scale game, whether it be Fidelity, Ameritrade, or Schwab. And despite that, you've actually had some early successes. I was hoping you can talk about the digital focus in particular and how that's enabled you to really grow the platform.
Yeah. We didn't purchase TCA to be a late entrant into the scale game. The fundamental reason we purchased it is really to close a product gap that we saw. We have a lot of customers that grow up with us, open up an account, deposit money over time, invest quite successfully on their own. But when they get to a larger amount of assets, the amount of sales pressure from the advised channels, from the wirehouses, is pretty intense, and we do lose a portion of them. This gives us the ability to set up a referral network to high-quality advisors that are on our platform. We've signed some very large industry stalwarts onto our advisor network already. It's early days. We just got the advisor program stood up in Q4, but we're seeing success already in terms of internal referrals to those advisors. It also gives us the ability, with the corporate services business, to position advisors into the corporate stock plan business, to form advisory relationships with employees who have that evergreen source of wealth and are looking for more of a financial advice solution versus the solutions we have offered historically. We think that's going to be a great tool to drive penetration and to drive asset flows from that base over time. That's really the strategy behind the TCA acquisition. We saw a highly technology-centric platform that we can integrate into our own platform. We can build that advisor network, and we can internalize and source and drive additional asset flows from it. TCA was a profitable company and growing nicely when we bought it. We've added to that growth considerably, signing $13 billion of commitments from advisors to move onto the platform. So, you know, as we look at it, we don't need to win the scale game to have this really drive compelling shareholder value over time within our model.
So, Mike, you touched on some of the growth drivers. I wanted to transition to the operating margin targets that you guys had outlined recently. So 50% in 2020. If I look at where your competitive set is, most of the e-brokers are operating in the high 40s. Regional banks, albeit an imperfect comp, are operating somewhere in the low 40s. What supports, well, what's unique about your business that really supports that stronger profitability profile that you see through the cycle?
Yeah. Let's go back to my opening comment. We're a digital-first business. We do not have the extensive sort of branch networks or footprints of some of our competitors. Those branch networks drive distributed labor costs in the management and personnel. They drive the leasehold expense, in terms of just paying the rent, so to speak, on those branches. We lead in a very efficient way with our customers. We're centered around 30 branches in large markets, and we operate out of two national sales centers. It is the way we go to market drives additional efficiency. Additionally, I would say that when we get comparisons to competitors all the time, and while we're very excited about our advisor business, it's small in comparison to what our competitors have. Advisor business is a lower-margin business. You can see that right in the revenue yield on client assets. We own the relationship to the end retail customer. We're not sourcing that relationship through a third-party advisor, by and large. What that really means is that we're able to generate more revenue on those client assets. Our revenue yield on client assets is more than twice our largest competitor. That's really a composition of the business as well as just the efficient way in which we go to market. All of that combined leads us to think that we should be able to operate at the highest operating margin in the space.
Okay, just one more for me, and then we'll open up to the audience. Mike, I just wanted to touch on the theme of consolidation. You know, this is something where we've seen quite a bit over the past decade, a lot of firms combining. The synergies are clearly quite compelling. I was hoping you can give some perspective on the importance of scale and maybe just broadly or how E*TRADE fits into the consolidation narrative.
Sure. We get a lot of questions around scale, but I think if we just go back to some of the points I made prior, the highest ROCA really in the space among the competitive set in terms of revenue yield on client assets. Operating margin of target of 48% this year, 50% next year, growing to mid-50s. You know, of the competitive set, really the highest revenue per employee. There is nothing in these stats that suggests subscale in any way, right? We have a great plan. We're going to execute on the delivery of that plan. We think that plan delivers compelling shareholder value. Now, we understand the acquisition economics. We understand them quite well. We've seen it right within our own three acquisitions that we've sort of delivered over these past three years. So if someone really wants to own the value of our plan, what is driving our plan forward, we're not gonna stand in the way of that. We understand that it's there, but at the same time, we understand the value that we can create by executing our in-force model well over the next 5 years to deliver on our goals. And we feel really strongly about our ability to do that, and we're gonna continue to go do that.
All right, so I'll open up to the audience, see if anyone has any questions. There in the front.
Hi, Mike. Just a quick follow-up on your operating margin target for 2019. You got it to a 48% target. Was just curious, do you think you can achieve that 48% operating margin target in a scenario where your interest-earning assets remain flat versus 4Q levels?
We have looked at a variety of scenarios around our operating margins. You know, and I think what you have to understand is a bit of the earnings resiliency of our business. If you look at last year, with the successive record levels of net buying, and last year coming in above $13 billion, an all-time record, it put pressure on cash balances. And so what that really, you know, but there were other offsets to that, in terms of daily avenue revenue trades being at a record for the year, margin balances, securities lending balances. Those are the natural offsets to an environment of very high engagement that drive cash balances lower overall. If we see the environment turn, we'll most likely see higher cash balances against a backdrop of lower business metrics in terms of DARTs, margin, securities lending, other items. And I think that gives us a great degree of earnings resilience. And so we don't necessarily need to see significant asset growth to drive towards the revenue goals that will support that operating margin. And so overall, today, sitting here, we feel very good about the 48% guidance for this year and the 50% for next year.
All right, Mike, maybe it would be helpful if you could just unpack some of those comments a little bit more as it
Sure.
relates to earnings resiliency. You know, one of the things that I think is most underappreciated is how well the earnings hold up during periods where the market has experienced a significant drawdown. And was hoping you could at least speak to the individual levers where, in the event that we experience maybe not a recession, but a bear market correction, rates remain flat, how you expect your earnings to hold up in that scenario. Are you still confident that you can deliver on your targets?
Yeah, I think you have to understand, like, the various revenue drivers and how they correlate. And what helps is sort of unpack it a little bit more of kind of the point I just made around the environment we've been in over the last 2 years. Over the last 2 years, we've seen investors, retail engagement increase year on year, really probably going back even maybe 3 or 4 years if you plotted it out. What that's led to is consistent levels of net buying increasing year on year. That has put pressure on cash balances as client cash as a percent of assets has gone down in each period. The structural forces in our business that generate cash growth are very much intact. Net new accounts, corporate services proceeds, customer trading activity, dividends, interest, rebalancing back to a portion of cash, and now really even advisor growth, bringing on a new source of cash growth. Putting all those together, you have a structural driver of cash growth against the volatility of client engagement in the marketplace. If you go back to periods where net buying was very low, you'll see we had outsized cash growth. We also had low DARTs and a fairly low margin book in those periods. It's not to say this is a perfect hedge of money moving in and out of the market, as some people were thinking. It's more of a structure within the business that drives a degree of earning resiliency across cycle, as those are natural offsets within our business model.
So, Mike, one of the things that we haven't touched on really is capital management prioritization. I was hoping you could speak to how you guys are balancing the need to invest for organic growth while supporting buyback, just given the relative attractiveness in terms of valuation on your stock today.
Yeah, we outlined in Q3 a target of a payout ratio of 80%-90%. But I think what's important about that target is it's not aspirational. It's not what we want to do. It's really the result of the execution of the model. It's an output, right? We believe we're going to start with the investments we want to make and how we're running our business, what revenue we're going to drive off of that, what net income comes, what free cash flow is left, and then what we can do with that cash flow. We're not going to sit on that excess capital. That's what leads us to returning that 80% to 90% type level. You know, we're in a business that doesn't require a substantial amount of CapEx to grow. That gives us a lot of flexibility around the deployment of that capital, you know, whether it be to dividends or to stock buybacks. We started a dividend in Q3. We listened to our investors broadly and what the value of that dividend might be. And so we will continue to manage capital from what we think is the most optimal strategy to drive shareholder value. You know, I think we've been very disciplined on the acquisition front. Of the three acquisitions that I've led for the company, looking at them, you know, very clearly, all three drove significant value day one in terms of the synergies they drove, and really achieved the IRRs necessary to justify the use of that capital in an acquisition. We are not going to change our discipline focus. So if we are going to divert capital away, you know, from share buybacks to an acquisition to grow, that acquisition is going to have to achieve the capital hurdles that a buyback would achieve. That discipline is not going to change. I think buybacks give us a tremendous, it's really within our model to generate this amount of free cash flow. I think it becomes a very compelling driver of value over time as you look at sort of the consistency and size of it.
Right. And Mike, one of the things that you've also built into the model is some flexibility around deploying cash either into the bank or sweeping it into the bank versus having it off balance sheet. And I was hoping you can give some context as to what that flexibility allows in the model, and in particular, how you think about relative risk return in deciding, should we leave that cash at the bank versus actually maintaining it off balance sheet?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we have grown our balance sheet significantly from when we made the decision to move through the $50 billion barrier. But one of the key elements of that is to grow your balance sheet requires capital. You have to look at the return on that capital in terms of the value of that growth. As the yield curve flattens, we are in a place today where on off-balance sheet deposits, we can earn roughly 250 basis points, right around the Fed funds type level. On on-balance sheet deposits, we have an investment range in the 3 to 325 basis point range overall, depending on where rates and spreads are. As we sort of look at that evolution, could we get to a place where it's more beneficial for shareholders if we pushed more money off balance sheet, freed up additional capital, and deployed that capital into buybacks? Well, obviously valuation matters, but as you point out, today's relative valuation makes that look more compelling. Right now, we still think that sort of, you know, maintaining course, continuing to grow the balance sheet overall makes the most sense. But we are close to environments where that calculus can change. And, you know, the point that we are making here is that we will do what is best to drive value for our shareholders. We are not sort of looking at one view as better for the long run or short run. We will do what's better to drive value. And overall, what that really means to us is if it's better to move those deposits off balance sheet over time, free up that capital, and increase the buyback, we will do that.
Hi, Mike. I'd love to get your thoughts. Just what do you think is the opportunity or the risk in your business with kind of ETFs, with some of the more traditional asset managers introducing kind of no-fee type products? Like, how do you see that as an opportunity? How do you see that as a risk? And just love your perspective on that.
I mean, ETFs, by and large, have been a great opportunity for us, whether it's what we've been able to do with them in our investment product suite in terms of sort of driving the investment costs lower and building them into our sort of asset allocation models, whether it's pre-built portfolios or our robo-portfolios. They've been an opportunity on the trading side as new ETFs that allow customers to trade strategies in a very efficient, liquid way that they might not otherwise, like taking sector views or leveraged views on things that they might not be able to do otherwise. So they've supported trade volumes. So by and large, the growth of the ETF complex has been very helpful overall, both from a trading business as well as an investing business. You know, we don't manufacture products, so the fee compression that's occurring in that space is really not something that has a direct impact on us. It has some indirect impacts, but nothing really in the sort of direct way on us. By and large, this has just increased the sort of universe of things customers can do on our platform. But when we look at sort of our core customer, that core actively engaged customer base, whether it's on the trading side or whether it's sort of that sort of do-it-yourself or on the investment side that's really looking at tools and building out products, the sort of building out a portfolio, the customer that is engaging with us, our target customer, this is just increasing the breadth of things they can do with us by having more ETF product in the marketplace at a lower cost.
I think we're out of time, but Mike, thanks so much for joining me up here, and so we'll pass it along to the next presentation.
Thank you.